Tell us the worst Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 16. Is it 15, 16? I can't remember. Somewhere in the mid-teens of, if this is a podcast, then what's Christmas? Today, I'm having a chat with Sean Doyle, who is the funniest man in advertising. Or at least that's my opinion, that he is the funniest man in advertising. But he's also a really, really, really good copywriter. And we talk about humor and humor in his copywriting and moments where I just found him funny outside of his writing. And, you know, he's done a bit of stand-up and won an award for it. So there you go. There's no argument. He's funny. But, you know, Sean, I was lucky enough to kind of work with, not in creating ads together, but he was there at AMV for advice and sort of gently taking the piss out of you when you went into his and Dave's office with an ad. And yeah, he's just always been a really nice bloke. And if you listen to this conversation, I think it'd be really hard to come to any other conclusion. So without further ado, here's my chat with Sean. Thank you for making the time to chat to me on New Year's Day, Sean. That's very kind of you.
No problems.
Great. Well, I'm going to really boringly and predictably begin by asking you how and why you got into advertising. There we go.
Well, I remember the moment, actually, when I thought I'd like to get into advertising. I was working in a factory making Ford truck parts. I say making them. I just used to take one big slab of metal and stick it in a big machine, press a button, there'd be some clanking noises, and then it came out a different shape, and I'd put it in a skip and then just repeat. So now I was doing that for about, that was about 18 years old, and I was doing this for about 3 months, and I just thought, oh God, no, I want to do something else. What talent do I have? And no, it wasn't really anything at school I was particularly good at apart from English. So it was obvious that it would have to have something to do with English. So, like Paul Burke mentioned, very similar career path to him, actually. I thought at first, should I be a journalist? And then I looked at a couple of newspapers and thought, oh, God, no, that's way too hard. Loads of big words there. I'm just too thick to do that. So then I thought, advertising copywriter. Someone must be writing those headlines in magazines and on posters. And it's all sorted out in a day, really. I realised I should be trying to go for that. It seemed more my level. You know, like quick flashes of writing as opposed to long, concentrated, intelligent writing. I thought, I have the brain for that. That's my level. So, from then on, I just decided to go for copywriting. And again, like Paul Burke, I just looked in the Yellow Pages. Only this was the Manchester Yellow Pages. And I looked at loads of advertising agencies, got loads of numbers, called lots of them up, and I got a job as a junior production assistant at a place in Manchester called Royds McCann, part of the McCann network. But it wasn't as a copywriter. They didn't have a vacancy for an 18-year-old copywriter for some reason.
Amazingly.
But they did have a job as a, I think it was junior production assistant, and it was $3,500 a year, so naturally I leapt on it. And, that was my first job.
And what year was that?
God, what year was it? I was 18, so it was 84 or 5.
Right.
Something like that. And, I remember it being nerve-wracking. It was a whole different world. I was there on my first day, for my first week, actually, in a suit that was way too tight for me, which I'd bought with my mum's help, especially for the job interview. I was just sweating all week long. You know, being in this brand new environment.
Yeah.
A middle class environment, posh people floating around, smelling nice. And there were men called Charles and Nigel, and I'd never met Charles or Nigel before. And so there I was, age 18, in the production department, not really knowing what I was doing.
And were you trying to get, was it on your mind to get out of the production department and into the creative department?
Oh, yeah, for definite. I mean, that day when I realised I wanted to do advertising copyright, that was always the aim. But I got in this production position, and I just floated around, not really learning anything for about a year. And then I thought, come on, I've got to do something about this, because I wasn't progressing anyway in that job. I was on black and white stuff, and we had to progress to colour after about a year. And I just didn't have a clue what to do. I just didn't understand anything about production. I don't know how I blagged it. I think because I was on so low a wage, it really didn't matter. As long as I was there doing something, it just didn't matter. But yeah, I wanted to be a copywriter still. So what did I do? I sent off some writing examples to other advertising agencies. I'd taken loads of magazines and newspapers that I'd found in the agency, pulled ads out, and just rewrote those headlines with my versions of them. Sent them off to lots of different places in Manchester and Leeds. And I got a job, got offered a job as a junior copywriter for a place called Poulter's in Leeds.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I was 19 then. And, yeah, that's when the copywriting began.
And you didn't think of applying to, like, London agencies at that time? Were you just wanted to stay in the north of England?
Yeah, I mean, that's where I'm from, and I had a girlfriend in Leeds, so it was just a perfect fit, really. London didn't occur till about, like, a couple of years later or something like that. So I was in Poulter's, worked with a couple of art directors called Wayne Hansen and Pete Ogden, and, just stayed there, learning my trade, until what happened? I think we got sacked. We got sacked. I was with Pete Ogden, and we got sacked over a wine throwing incident. Those were the days when you could you could get sacked. There was no redundancy and political stuff. You just did something naughty, and someone sacked you for it. So it's quite funny. It was a Christmas party, and me and Oggy had taken some carafes of wine up to our office for some reason. We're in there, and we're only young, about 20 years old. I threw a carafe of wine at him. not the contents, not the actual the glass.
Oh, right, yeah.
It went all over him. He swore at me and then chased me down this corridor. And we're running down the corridor, coming towards this door at the end. And just before he realised I was about to slow down to pull open this door to carry on running, but I ducked into this side room off the corridor. The door opened and the creative director was coming through in his cream chinos, just as Oggy let the carafe of wine fly, and it just went all over his kecks. And shortly after that, 2 months later, we were sacked, and I think that was the reason.
Yeah.
Well, good way to go.
When you said you were learning your trade, was there something you were deliberately doing to improve your writing then? Like, were you looking at DNADs or anything like that, or what were you doing?
Yeah, I mean, that's, DNAD was obviously the best place to, because you got to learn how to do it before you can break the rules, haven't you? And do it well. So, yeah, we were looking at DNAD ads, and American ads were starting to get good again, because for a while, American advertising was just shit. Yeah. And then suddenly in the late 80s, I think it was around then, places like Fallon McGilligan started coming to the fore, and they were just doing these just some amazing ads. There's one I always remember from that period. I can't remember if it was Fallon or some other place in Richmond, but it was just the dreariest little brief. It was a small print ad, and the brief was to say we're having a closing down sale, 50% off. And I remember this headline just said, 50% off during our closing down sale. Oh, sure, now you'll come in. And I just thought that was fantastic. And, just looking at stuff like that and David Abbott's stuff and what have you, that's the best way to learn, isn't it? You just look at other great ones and you try and be like that. So, yeah, we were steeping ourselves in stuff like that. Then we got fired, and then we thought then it's time to go to London, try down there. So me and Oggy went to London, with our book. This was the days when you had to cart your book around, your portfolio in a big A2 case. And what did we do? Yeah, we went to loads of different agencies, saw a different couple of agencies each day. And within a couple of weeks, we got offered a job at BBDO.
Yeah.
This was before it merged with AMV. The creative director there was Andrew Nicol, who was this Kiwi guy who was really good, but in a bad agency. I think he got fired.
But then went on that, to write The Truman Show and Gattaca and all the other amazing films he made.
I know. So, yeah, he did bleeding well out of it, really well.
And were Tom and Walt there at the time? Sorry.
They just turned up there. So this was pre-AMV. They turned up. They were really weird. We'd never met anyone like them, really. You know, wearing all black and just doing crazy stuff. And that was interesting. And that carried on for about 2 years. It was interesting being in a London agency. God, you know what? I can't remember a bleeding thing. We did loads of rubbish there, but I think that's fine. I think we were about 23 years old at the time, so we were still young. But kept on looking at these American ads and what have you, and just learning and constantly working on the book. And then suddenly this place started up in London, which was Simons Palmer Denton.
Oh, yeah.
And they were just so hot, and I really wanted to work there. My partner, Oggy, didn't want to work there because, he thought the place was fantastic, but I think he was just a bit fed up of me because it was, in a team, one person always tends to take charge a bit.
Yeah.
And I was just obsessed with, working all through the night and what have you, and I was quite irritating to be with, I think. So he thought, no, stay here. You go and you have a go yourself. So, yeah, I went. I sent my work there and desperate to get in there. And I couldn't believe it when they took me on. It was just a dream. I had to take a drop in wages and what have you. But that was the price to pay back then, to work in a better place.
Yeah. So did you, did Mark do the interview? Did Chris do the interview? How did all that go?
I think I came in and saw them both, and I was scared stiff because I'd seen pictures of them in Campaign. They looked like an interesting, scary, creative couple. They both interviewed me. They didn't talk much about the work, and the best people I've ever met they're not really good at talking about the work. They just like something or they don't, and their standards were just higher, so they would just dislike most of your work. They'd just say no until you get to a great one, and they'd say yes. And all the best people throughout my career have been like that, like Tim Delaney and Palmer and Denton. They don't really say much apart from no. And they just say no for longer until you get to a really good place. It's so simple, really.
Yeah, so
not rocket science, but it's just really simple attitude.
And you did some good Nike work there. And what else was knocking around as a client for you?
Well, I did that a Nike ad. It's not the winning; it's the taking apart. Mark made look amazing. Apart from that, what did I do? There was bits and bobs. There was a TV campaign that was, I thought it was really funny at the time, and it got in the book and everything. It was for Tandon Computers. And it was a really nice old-fashioned kind of problem to solve, because there were three computery type clients around that time called Tandy, Tandem, and Tandon. We had Tandon, and we just simply had to differentiate ourselves. So we did this TV campaign, just featuring on the ON bit on the end, featuring these two characters called Stan and Don. What were they doing? who were just goofing around doing silly stuff. And it was just one of those really silly, heavily branded exercises, you know, where you had to do nothing but get the ON bit across to differentiate themselves from Tandem and Tandy. And so it just made sense. We have Tan and Don, split it up that way, Stan and Don. And it's so silly when I think about it now, saying it out loud, but it worked really well. It was great because there was no thinking about the target market too much, no worrying about tone of voice, and you know all the things that you do have to do these days, all the very grown-up stuff. You just had to make sure people got the tanned on bit, and so simple, so enjoyable to work on.
Yeah, I think in my very nerdy, like I was looking at, I think it's in like the 95 DNAD or something, I don't know, but I remember there was a big fashion about 5 years later for personifying some element of the company. People like wore t-shirts that said, you know, like I'm this or I'm that or whatever it was. And I think yours was probably the forerunner of all that. Didn't they have t-shirts with Stan and Don on them?
That was it, yeah, yeah. The Stan fella had a Stan t-shirt on, the other one had a Don on, and yeah, I like to think, yeah, forerunner. I don't mind that.
Forerunner.
I'll take that.
Yeah.
Yes, good. Thanks. I've worked with some great people there as well. I worked with Andy Mackay, Keith Bickle, Keith Courtney, and Mark himself. It was just great. And so many good clients and so many good people through the door as well. Tim Riley worked there, and some other American guy who, God, I should know his name, but I can't remember it. But now it was just fantastic. In the early days, when they were above a sandwich shop in Covent Garden, and it was just bliss. You know, the briefs were just amazing. They were just so simple. There was about 30 words on the entire brief. And it was just something like, luncheon vouchers are cheap, something like that. Who are we appealing to? People who might have luncheon vouchers. That was it. Do you know what I mean? There's no in-depth. It wasn't rocket science. It was just so, so simple. But that's what it's about, isn't it? If we're communicating, then we've got to keep it simple.
Absolutely.
I think even to this day, I know the world's more complex and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So people think in advertising, as a result, you know, briefs should maybe be more complex and what have you. But at the end of the day, no, we're still communicating. You've got to be dead simple.
Yeah, and did you, because was Dave there at the same time? Is that when you first met Dave Dye?
No, Dave was he after me? I think he came, yeah, I left there to go to WCRS with Keith Courtney. It was a mistake to leave Simon's Palmer after just a couple of years. But no, Dave, I'd met him before on my travels, going around with my book. He's really helpful at seeing anyone's portfolio. I'd met him before once or twice, I think, trawling my book around. But he wasn't there then, no. That was like, I'd meet up again with him about 2 or 3 years later at Lagos.
WCRS was quite interesting at that time, if I remember rightly, because my friend's mum worked there, so I occasionally popped in. Wasn't it in Longacre at that point? Or
that was in Longacre, and yeah. That was just, yeah, that was not very good creatively, I don't think. This was sort of when they used to do Great Carlin Black Label ads, and we got there. They still had Carlin Black Label, but this was just after. When we joined, I think it was just after Kez Gray and Jonathan Greenosh were doing those great Carlin Black Label Dan Busters ads and Squirrel ads and yeah. What have you. It was, to be honest, it was starting to go downhill, that account then. Wasn't quite the place it was just a few years earlier. But it was fun working there. In the wrong way, you know. There's a lot of there's a great social life. Not that I indulged in it much, but you know, there's a free bar every Friday and lots of messing around in the computer in the creative department, throwing rugby balls about, and just that general larking around and the early 90s. Yeah, not a great career move. I should have stayed at Simons Palmer, really, if I knew what was good for me. Oh. But we all make mistakes, you know. And I went there, and that was like a couple of years of my life.
And Dave said you were. They said you were commuting down from Leeds to go to Lucas Delaney. So were you commuting from Leeds before then, or had you moved to London?
No, I'd. Well, I've got family who are up there. They've been up there nearly all the time. So I was commuting up and down on weekends. But when I first really started travelling up and down every day, that was when I was at Lucas Delaney. Right. Yeah. Because after this WCRS, I've been to hundreds of agencies for a very short period. And after WCRS, I went back up north for family reasons. And I stuck it out about a year then. And I had to think about going to London again to get a job because I was on quite a high salary considering it was up north at Polars, which was my second stint there. And that's quite dangerous being on a high salary there because if they were going to get rid of me, which they must have surely been thinking about because I wasn't getting any good work out, then there were only a couple of other decent options in the entire north of England, whereas in London there are hundreds of other agencies. So I needed to work in London. So I thought, is it possible to live up north and work in London? I had a go and yeah, I got a season ticket. Lucas Delaney offered me a job because Dave, who was there then, this was after his stint at Simons Palmer Denton, he'd mentioned me to Tim Delaney and yeah, I got offered a job there and then I started travelling down from Yorkshire to London every day working at Lucas, which was knackering.
Yeah, and Dave was saying that, it, I mean, Lucas was, well, and then Emma Stamp said you had reviews at 3 a.m. or whatever. So how did your, I guess, having to leave the office at 4 o'clock and turn up at 10 or whatever, work with Tim's rather brutal work ethic?
Yeah, well, that was tough. That I was rarely doing any crazy middle-of-the-night reviews.
Right.
I think those reviews did go on, I think. I think Tim would work till he'd have an early night, you know, leave at 8:30 sometimes, probably go out to dinner with a client and then come back at midnight and you'd have your review with him then. But for the first year when I was doing that travelling, luckily I missed all that stuff. I would just, I'd have to leave at 6:30 every day in order to get back home to Yorkshire by about 10 o'clock. I mean, it swings and roundabouts. It was tiring, but at the same time, I got a lovely couple of hours on a train in the morning, you know, to get a really good head start on the Lucas work. And then that night at the end of the day, I could prepare for tomorrow's work, get a head start on that, on the long train journey on the way home. So it worked out really, really well. Just shattering, but that old cliche, you know, we're not working in the mines or driving a tube, what have you, it's not that difficult really. All I was doing was sitting down on a train. But I do remember the first day there being really scary. I'd heard all the rumours about Lucas Delaney and you know, and what a slave driver Tim was. And I remember on the first day I'd got a brief. And I saw him around lunchtime and said, oh, I've got an idea on that thing. Can I show you after lunch? And he said, an idea. And I just shat myself. And I went to see the team sitting next door, Rob and Dave. I said, how many ideas have you got? Because they were working on the same brief. And I think they said they had 20 or 30 ideas. And I thought, oh, no, I can't do that many. But if you have to adapt, you adapt, don't you? It's human nature. I don't know how I was supposed to have so many ideas in such a short space of time, but if that's what other people were doing, then it's possible. And you just make yourself do 20 or 30 ideas in an afternoon. It's, you just have to be that way if you're working there. And I mean, it would have been impossible to do so many ideas per day if briefs were complicated and what have you. But again, like the best places, the briefs were really simple and clear, much like Simon's Palmer Denton. You just get a really clear brief and you just do hundreds of ideas, and then Tim goes through them and does his, as you've heard, he does all his piles. He does his no pile and his yes pile. And if you started to get a build up of two piles, you think, oh, thank God, at least there are some yeses there. And they weren't just pieces of paper he was putting on a yes pile. Those things were going to get made, because no account man would dare come back really and say to Tim, we couldn't sell this one. He'd go ballistic. If he said yes to something, that meant it was going to appear somewhere within a month.
Did you ever have that thing where you tried to guess what the yes pile was and the no pile was and get it wrong? Because sometimes I did that, and I'd like give it to, say, Peter Souter, and he'd make yes pile and a no pile. And I'd go, oh, good, he likes the one I like. And then it'd turn out that the yes pile was the no pile. Did that ever happen to you?
I know what you mean. Yeah, you'd always try and work it out. And that was the exciting bit, when he'd put one piece of paper on the left, one on the right, and you're thinking, hang on. These are the two ads at the top of the pile. They're at the top of the pile for a reason.
Yeah.
Because they're my favourites. Those two should have been in the same pile. they should be in the yes pile. But either way, just as long as you've got two piles, even if there's 20 on one side and three on the other, that's fine, really.
Yeah.
There was a tiny bit of leeway where he might say, have I missed anything you think's great? And you think, well, I really do like this one. And you try and get it over to the yes pile, and he'd say nah, and that was kind of the end of that. I mean, that was the best advice I've ever had, really. It's not advice, it's just the word no.
Yeah,
it's just so good to get the word no. And I do remember, though, Tim could be really scathing in reviews sometimes. It wouldn't be just no or yes, he'd throw in an insult now and again that, oh god, he could do some killer insults without swearing. I once went in with a headline that I thought was quite nice, and it must have been really childish or something. He just looked at it and frowned and said to me, how old are you? It doesn't get much more cutting than that.
No.
Thankfully, I was only 27, so he couldn't go. You know, I could say, well, I'm only 27, I don't really know what I'm doing yet. But how old are you? It was a killer of an insult.
Yeah. And so you teamed up with Dave there. How did that process end up happening?
Well, I worked with, before working with Dave, I worked with a couple of really good art directors, Steve Paskin and Tom Hudson. And I think I was working mainly with Steve for a good few months, doing some Adidas stuff and some Pepe jeans stuff. And then Tim put me with Dave Dye. And that's when I really started to get loads of stuff out, because it was easy in a way. It'd be a case of, here's a brief. We need a campaign for Adidas or English Heritage. Here's what we've got to say. See you tomorrow with your ideas. And you do some great ideas. You stay up all night, get to some great stuff. They get made. They actually run. And just like a miracle. It seems like a foreign land now.
Yeah.
You come up with a good idea and it runs. Jesus, that just seems insane now. But the reason we got so many pieces of work through was all down to Dave, really, because he was just dead ambitious. He just had to get stuff made. I was ridiculously unambitious. If an account person came back and stole the ore, I'd be like, okay, have another one. But Dave wouldn't have any of that. And I mean, he was right, because that lack of preciousness by me was wrong. You're supposed to care. It's really unprofessional, and it's just uncaring to be so, never mind. You've got to love these babies that you're producing. But that just naturally wasn't in me. I couldn't be that precious. I sometimes had to pretend to be. So if ever an ad wasn't sold for some reason, I had to pretend I was really bored and go, oh, no, really? Why? What the hell? But to me, there's always another idea.
Yeah, and I think Dave told me once that, and I might mention it to Dave, that if you and he both came up with an idea that, you know, the other one wasn't sure of or didn't like enough, you'd come up with a third idea. And I think I said to him, how many great ideas bit the dust because you couldn't agree on them? But I guess if you think there's always another good idea out there, then you can just keep going.
Yeah, you can. And I really think that usually the best work is just a case of the amount of time you put in. I think you start like for just a tiny bit of skill, creativity, whatever it is, and the rest of it is just how many hours are you prepared to put in. So I mean, it just stands to reason if you do 10 ideas, you're going to get to a certain standard. If you carry on and work into the night and you get to 20 or 30 ideas, the standard is going to go up. Yeah. Just for the sheer fact that if you're thinking longer and harder, the sheer fact that you've got those ideas already means you've got to do something quite lateral in your second batch, not to repeat the first lot. So you go off into more interesting creative places. So I do think that the best work comes through hard work, extra work. And Legis Delaney's great for that because, the amount was important.
I think that's really interesting because...
Not for quantity's sake.
Yeah, and I remember hearing an interview with Louis C.K. where basically he wants to come up with at least an hour of new material every year because he goes, once you've done the early stuff, that's like the first ideas and whatever. If you're forced to you can't do those, you've got to do some more, you end up in a really unusual place because you've got to start thinking of totally different things. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that just makes so much sense, doesn't it? You're just avoiding the earlier cliched stuff. The stuff that's going to occur to you first of all, they're obviously going to be closer to the brief and correct and, you know, nothing wrong with them. They tick the box and what have you, but they're not going to be as lateral because you're not thinking laterally. You're thinking, obviously, you know, what's the right answer to this? Yeah, this one fits. And then you just go on. Couple of hours later, you're steaming away and you just go off on bizarre tangents.
Yeah.
And from there, you know, if it's too bizarre but really interesting, you can sort of pull it back a little bit and make it... I've lost track now, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm also wondering, like, at Legis, you had to actually write some really long copy stuff, like English Heritage. Was that, like, the first time you'd really had to do that? And what was it like writing that stuff into... Tim, of all people.
That was quite funny, the the English Heritage stuff. I mean, the best one of those was, I think it was ridiculously long. I think it was 21 words or something like that, which was for Walmer Castle, which was when you build a castle for a king who's renowned for chopping people's heads off, you build a really nice castle. That was insanely long. I think it was 22 words. And as everyone knows, a headline's supposed to be about 7 or 8 words, really. But, we just thought, if anyone's going to look at this ad at all, if it looks nice and elegant and inviting and seems well-crafted, they're going to read that block of copy in the middle, the headline, if it's a 22-word headline, as much as they are if it was an 8-word headline. And, there is a way to rewrite that really long headline, do it much shorter, but it wouldn't be nearly as good. So that was the headline, but all the copy around it, that was, I don't think I've ever read that since. That was, that must have been about 1,000 words. And I don't know how I managed that, because that wasn't just writing, that was shaping as well. Because it was all metal set or something, or wood set, I can't remember. It was a some art director typographer term. But everything had to be, every single line and those 1,000 lines had to be the perfect amount of characters for Dave Wakefield, who was setting it. And so he'd phone up and say, right, here's today's revisions. Could you take 1.5 characters out of this line? Add 4 characters to that line. And this isn't like, I take out a... one and a half words or add four words. These were characters. So, for instance, if there's one short sentence and it had too many M's in it, which are quite long, I'd have to literally rewrite it and still have it make as much sense to look perfect as well as read perfectly.
Wow.
Really difficult, but really indulgent as well, but oh, it was really enjoyable at the same time. Like I say, we're not down a mine, so it's not really that hard.
Yeah, absolutely.